Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Dean Waldo, continuing his series on the environment. Today's session is number 6 and is titled Ozone Depletion: Misconceptions and Prospects for the Future. Let's listen in.
Welcome to this session. My name is Dean Waldo, and today's session is ozone depletion. What did I call it? Misconceptions and prospects for the future, or something like that. And I'm a chemistry professor at Pacific Lutheran University, just to give you a little background. I normally teach physical chemistry, general chemistry, lots of chemistry classes, and actually don't talk about ozone much, but it's kind of fun to have a chance to talk about perhaps a little bit more global perspective question. And I'd like to just mention that if you have any questions along the way, feel free to ask a question. Maybe don't throw the pellets from the upper balcony. Unless you don't hear me, then okay. But then you've got to wander through the microphones. Let's see what else. Oh. I just wanted to start out with references, because I keep forgetting to mention references. I'm taking a lot of this material, at least some of the material, from a book. There's one chapter in here about ozone. This is a book called The Next 100 Years by Jonathan Weiner, where he's detailed or gone through many global climatic type changes. Predominant one is really global warming, and this is sort of one small piece of global warming, but it's one small piece that we're sort of getting a handle on. And actually, one of the other resources that I've been using is actually from internet, which is a little hard to access from Holden, but some of you folks have access to internet, because many people. Well, if you ever want to see one of the most information-laden sites I've ever seen on the internet, is if you go to the EPA homepage, EPA worldwide website, and here's the address if you ever want to go net surfing. It has an incredible array of information, one of the most complete references I've seen, and they have references to information from NASA, as well as the Canadian, a number of Canadian sources, and a few other sources around the world. But the information there is really excellent, and it's quite amazing. You often hear tales of internet being nothing but fluff, but there's some really very useful information there. So I'll be taking a lot of it from there, some from this book and general chemistry books and things like that. But there'll be no quiz at the end. Okay. So basically, what I'm going to do is essentially recap a little bit of what we talked about yesterday. So those of you who were here yesterday may hear a little bit of a repeat in some sense, but I won't be going into much about the Nobel Prize awardees. I talked mostly about the people who were awarded the Nobel Prize for their work in ozone. This time I'll give a little review about what ozone is, where it is in our atmosphere, why it's there, how it gets there, how it gets destroyed. Talk a little bit about then some of the ideas or misconceptions that go into the ozone layer, and then some of the results from something called the Montreal Protocol, which is a treaty, in a sense, between about 150 industrialized countries throughout the world. And then we'll end with a little bit of prospectus for the future of our ozone layer. Okay. Well, I had to do a little advertising here. This is the view from Pacific Lutheran University of Mount Rainier, so can't see that from my office, unfortunately. But periodically I'll be showing some overheads or using the paper here.
Okay.
Well, how many of you folks have heard about, how many of you folks have heard about the ozone layer? Maybe I should say, who hasn't heard about the ozone layer? Has anyone not heard about the ozone layer? What I'd like to do is start out just reviewing what the ozone layer is, where it is, and a little bit about atmospheric chemistry. And it won't, we'll just use little models. We won't get too much into the chemistry. We might need to write a few equations on the board. But first, I think it's really important to think about our atmosphere. And we can just start with a little picture here. Actually, it might be less beneficial for my sake. Can everyone see okay?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, that will be this one.
How about this one? The edge one I could turn on.
That'd be good.
Okay.
Well, in a very simple sense, the Earth is at the center. I'm not trying to say the Earth is flat here, but there are basically three regions. There's more than three, but there's primarily three regions that are shown in this picture where the atmosphere is divided into these sections. First one is called the troposphere, the second one is the stratosphere, and the third one is the mesosphere. And essentially, the ozone layer we're talking about exists in the stratospheric layer. Ozone that's in the troposphere, essentially where we most of us live, even if we're flying an airplane. An airplane normally flies about in this area, 35,000 feet, 25 to 35,000 feet. So if you flew to Seattle or Spokane or something to come to Holden, then you're probably pretty close to the boundary between those two areas. And essentially, if ozone is in this region, or close to the surface of the Earth, then ozone is very dangerous in a sense. It can be very hard on lungs, tissue, plants, animals, cars, tires, pretty much anything. So ozone in the region closest to the Earth is really quite bad. Ozone in this region, since we don't have much contact with it, and it does one very useful thing. It blocks a certain kind of UV light, which is very damaging to our skin, animal skin, various, almost all of life. Even it can be very damaging to phytoplankton, the food for krill, I think it is called, that live in the ocean. So increase in that kind of UV light will could severely impact many forms of life. Well, if we take a little bit more detailed look at that, and add a few more words here. So here we have graphs, okay? If we just focus on this graph first, what we have is a plot where we have temperature along one axis, and we have altitude along another axis. And so the three layers I was showing you in the other graph are here, the troposphere, the stratosphere, and the mesosphere. And there's two other words on here, a tropopause and a stratopause. And that's essentially the boundary between these three layers. And let's just look at temperature. What happens to temperature? If we go up, if you've ever gone hiking, you generally know it gets colder as you go higher. Well, it keeps getting colder and colder until you get to the tropopause, and then all of a sudden temperature starts going up, and peaks around the place you get to the stratopause. And you know, those are really pretty broad boundaries. But essentially, the ozone layer exists in the stratosphere, and this is essentially the same altitude plotted from 0 to 60 kilometers. And the dashed line indicate the two pauses, the tropopause and the stratopause. And so ozone peaks somewhere in this area and has a little tail coming down into the tropopause, but most of it really is in that area. And since most of our interaction with the atmosphere is in this area, in the past, there hasn't been much that really goes into the stratosphere that's at least what's called anthropogenic. In other words, coming from humans affecting nature. Okay. One thing about the tropopause that's kind of interesting, it's very hard for things to go across that boundary in a sense. It may take 3 to 5 years or longer for something to traverse across that boundary. So we could put something in the atmosphere that may take a long time to get up to the tropopause. It may take even a lot longer to cross that boundary because there isn't a lot of mixing between the two layers.
There are obviously a lot of other characteristics about the tropopause that prevents that mixing, right? Besides just temperature fluctuations.
Oh yeah, apparently weather, what kind of top to bottom currents you would have, how well things get mixed up, it's interesting to note that below the stratopause, about 90% of all the mass in the atmosphere exists. If you go below the troposphere, about 70% of the mass of the atmosphere exists there. So once you get above, you know, the tropopause, there's much less mass associated with the atmosphere. Okay. So the two main things we want to focus on for thinking about the ozone layer would be, in a sense, looking at two different kinds of UV light that come from the sun towards our planet. There's a number of types of UV light, and it's a fairly broad continuum. But light that's less than, say, 240 nanometers, 290 nanometers, somewhere in there, light lower than that. And let me give you a little reference for that, what that means. You folks normally heard of wavelength of light in nanometers? So visible light is 400 nanometers, and that's sort of purple. And red is about 700 nanometers, and that's red. And so you start going below 400, and UV light gets very damaging to people, especially eyes. It can increase cancers for cancerous skin growths. It can cause cataracts in eyes. It quite often will reduce a body's potential to fend off disease, or in other words, lower immune system response, a number of things like that. Oxygen, normal oxygen, that's just O2, and my little oxygen here, normally will block most of that light below 240 or 250 nanometers, something like that. So the light comes into the atmosphere. What happens, you'll either break that apart and make two oxygen atoms from an oxygen molecule, or you might ionize it. A number of different mechanisms could happen. And what that does is it prevents that kind of light from getting to us. Now, there's a lot of oxygen throughout both parts of the atmosphere, so there really isn't a lot of concern about UV light from there. The real concern is the UV light that's a little closer to what we can see. In other words, 250 to 330 nanometers. And oxygen and nitrogen don't absorb that kind of light. And the only thing that really does of any real use is ozone. And that's a molecule that looks like this. We add one more oxygen to the O2 molecule and we have ozone. And this is the deleterious, the unhappy stuff you don't want to have at this light level. So what happens when that UV light comes down? It just, in a sense, knocks off one of the oxygen atoms, and then you're left with the normal oxygen and then an oxygen atom, a normal oxygen molecule. And also, you know, feel free if you have questions, stop me. So one of the things I'd like to look at first is, how does ozone normally get produced? And how does it normally get consumed? This is a fairly steady description of ozone. That ozone has been there, from what scientists have been able to decide, for quite a long time at a rather steady value or sustainable value. And what happens is the thing we just talked about, UV light hits that oxygen molecule, breaks it into atoms, and then one of those atoms will collide with an oxygen molecule and end up making ozone. In the process, there's usually another molecule that will be part of that, and it'll hit and send off some thermal energy. In other words, the gas in the atmosphere get a little hot. And that's partly why you see this increase in temperature as you go up to the stratopause, through the stratosphere. Because in forming ozone, we actually, in a sense, take that light energy and turn it into thermal energy. You get those atoms and molecules moving faster. And then when the light, the other UV light, the less energetic UV light comes in, it'll hit the ozone molecule and then disassemble it again. So it's sort of the ultimate recycling project. You take oxygen, recycle it from O2 to O3 and O over and over and over. So, what Well, are you familiar with what are the main problems with the ozone layer? What things are causing problems?
Aerosol cans.
Aerosol cans were?
But we don't have them anymore, so aren't we improving? Isn't the bowl getting smaller?
Okay, we're getting to that. Aerosol propellant used to have chlorofluorocarbons in them. And those are really turning out to be the major culprit in terms of ozone. Any other places you'd see
exhaust fumes, is that right?
Some exhaust fumes, some nitrous oxide, NO or NO2 gases, can go up in the atmosphere and cause problems with the ozone layer. They tend to be much smaller in volume. They usually get rained out as acid rain. Some of them can make it up to the stratosphere and cause ozone depletion.
Refrigeration.
Once the coolant, which is the freon, there's many kinds of freon, but once that freon gets out of the refrigerator, then it can migrate up to the upper atmosphere. Perhaps some of the worst actors were more industrial processes where they would just use gallons of this and splash it on electronic boards to clean them, electronics boards. Some chemical processing plants used ozone as a solvent and were not very careful with it because it was thought to be a very benign substance. The story I told yesterday is when the first scientists at DuPont discovered these, they were sort of competing with ammonia as a refrigerant, and that's very dangerous. If you would breathe ammonia, you can very easily damage your lungs. So the person, the scientist who made this, was giving the demonstration apparently to the higher-ups at DuPont, took a cylinder of this, inhaled a big gulp, blew it out, and sort of smiled and said, "See, this stuff doesn't hurt." it did solve one problem. In other words, an immediate health concern about using ammonia. But if we keep releasing this atmosphere, there's very little that CFCs or carbon chlorofluorocarbons will react with to get cleaned out of the environment. Just to show you that all you need to see is that there are lines in this paper. And there's about two pages. These are all different kinds of compounds that cause different kinds of chlorofluorocarbons that cause depletion to the ozone layer. And each compound has a ranking, something called an ODP, the ozone depletion potential. And they call freon 11 and 12 has a potential of 1, so anything that's worse has a higher number, anything that's better has a lower number. And they've gone through and characterized all of these in terms of how much chlorine they'll deposit in that part of the upper atmosphere. One other note about ozone depleting chemicals, they tend to be also chemicals which contribute to global warming. In other words, they help insulate the Earth, perhaps more than the Earth was meant to be insulated, or at least than it has been in recent history. And quite often, the ability of an ozone molecule to act as a global warming agent is very, very high. These numbers, I believe, are referenced to carbon dioxide as a reference. And like freon 12, which is quite common chlorofluorocarbon for refrigeration, has a potential of 8,500, so 8,500 times more potentially dangerous for the global warming than carbon dioxide. So even at very small levels, these can have a very large effect on global warming. And that piece of paper needs to stand there because we have to have a mystery. This is a picture of, as best as people have been able to put together, a picture of total chlorofluorocarbon production in the world. And what we see is there's a few data points in 1950, 1960, but about the time I was born, 1961 here, we started producing tremendous amounts of chlorofluorocarbons. And I put a couple asterisks here. About 1974, Molina and Rowland, two of the three people who received the Nobel Prize for their work on ozone depletion, published their paper about, well, maybe it was closer, just before this. And that's about the time that people started thinking about this and realizing, okay, maybe CFCs aren't that good. So the United States first banned CFCs in aerosol cans. I don't know if people remember that. About that time, then, the production slowed down and actually decreased for a while. And about in the early 80s, people were starting to say, oh, the ozone layer was just one of these panicky environmental scientist type folks who were crying Chicken Little or something, the sky's falling. And there was very little thought about it. Production kept going up in many other uses. Foaming plastics for styrofoam cups at the time. And they're still used as refrigerants and on and on. And so we're up to about 1,200 kilotons of production per year at about the peak in about 1988-1990. And the other point that I wanted to mark was this time, about 1986-87, and that's when something called the Montreal Protocol was enacted, a treaty between many of the industrialized nations of the world deciding to limit the amount of CFCs produced. Have you folks take away is an understanding why CFCs are so dangerous to ozone. So if this is freon 11, this is a little carbon molecule, carbon-based molecule, carbon in the center, then we have three chlorines attached to it and one fluorine. It's a fairly simple molecule. Quite often we use it as a thinking tool to teach organic chemistry, think about where atoms are relative to the central carbon. But what happens is when the chlorofluorocarbons are released, eventually they, over many years, go from the troposphere up to the stratosphere. And then these are also susceptible to the same kind of light that ozone is. I'm sorry, that O2 and nitrogen are. So when these are strong bonds in this molecule. So when a light of a certain frequency will come through, it can essentially knock a chlorine atom off this molecule. And so we have a free chlorine atom. That chlorine atom is incredibly reactive. It wants to react with almost anything it can. Oxygen and nitrogen are very unreactive, so it usually doesn't react with those that much. Oxygen, I mean diatomic, O2 or nitrogen N2. So chlorine will find an ozone molecule and essentially steal one of the oxygens from it, making a chloromonoxide and oxygen. Well, the chloromonoxide, the ClO, isn't done working yet. It can then react with just another oxygen atom and produce a normal oxygen molecule plus chlorine back again. So if we add these two things together, what we see is ozone plus an atom of oxygen combines to make two normal oxygen molecules. But what happened to the chlorine? It sort of is on both sides of that question. And so what happens is once we get it back as chlorine, it can then go back and react with more ozone. And over and over and over. One simple chlorine atom can destroy from 10,000 to 100,000 ozone molecules. So one chlorine atom can destroy, you know, a tremendous number of ozone molecules before the chlorine actually reacts with something else that'll actually take it out of the stratosphere. But it can last a tremendous amount of time. So does that, any questions about that? I'm not so concerned that you really remember all this, but the main thing I'm trying to emphasize is that once you get a chlorine atom, it can do a tremendous amount of damage to the ozone. This is something that's called a free radical mechanism. It's there any chemistry type people, or if you've heard of, you know, free radicals are bad for your body. So we have vitamins that often deal with those, vitamins A, C, E, things like that. They scavenge free radicals. But there aren't any real free radical scavengers in the ozone layer besides ozone. And so that will then decrease the amount of ozone. Well, when did you probably first start hearing about ozone a lot? Any ideas?
Mid-80s.
Mid-80s, and what was the phenomenon?
The hole,
yes. In other words, ozone decreased in a certain part of the world precipitously. Molina and Rowland, the first scientists who thought about this, predicted that ozone amounts would go down a few percent, which could be dangerous, but they didn't think they would go down that much. When they first discovered that ozone was dropping, oh, I'm sorry, we'll go ahead and pull it off. I need to actually keep this one so we can disclose the other information. But and when they first published their paper about ozone depletion, they thought it would be a few percent, something we should be pretty concerned about. But when they started seeing decreases in ozone that looked something like this, scientists were saying, okay, well, about the time they noticed that they were sort of at here, and this is sort of an arbitrary axis measuring the total amount of ozone, that if you were to look straight up through the atmosphere and you added all the ozone molecules up, it's called the total polymer ozone. And it measures, if there's ozone near the ground, it would also measure that. But in the Antarctica, where this is taken from, there really isn't much ozone on the ground. And so they were starting to know ozone was decreasing during the, over the South Pole, and didn't really understand why that was the case. And it would only do that sort of periodically during the Southern Hemisphere winter. And hence, came the first pictures about 1987, 1985, 86, 87 of what's called the ozone hole. Excuse me. And just to orient you what this is, we're looking essentially from straight up from the South Pole. And these colors here indicate amounts of ozone between the Earth and the outer atmosphere. And what you can see, purple is a lower number, so that means there's less ozone. Yellow, red, and these green colors are higher levels of ozone. And so what we're seeing is not really a hole in a sense, but a decrease in the concentration of ozone in those areas. And it was periodic. And let's just show me the tree. So if we start in January and go around in this direction, we have to sort of recalibrate our colors again. But blue in this case is low. I think it was the same way last time. It was low.
No, it was white.
Was it white? It's the bottom one. But so at 100, what's called a Dobson unit, that's low ozone concentration, and yellow is high. You can see that it's sort of around the pink color throughout March, April, May. Starting to get a little purple in June, came back to a little pink. Purple, getting darker purple, there's some blue in here. Then in October, what do you see? Very blue areas, a little less blue, then it starts decreasing. And that really sent major shockwaves throughout the scientific community, because this was depletion in the normal concentrations of ozone by not just a few percent, but lots of percent, 60, 70%.
Are they taking these measurements all over the world?
Yes.
And it just happens to be over the Antarctic?
That was the curious thing. Ozone was being depleted a lot during, over the Antarctic. And so the question was, well, why is it being depleted there, and what's causing the depletion? And the next thing we're going to talk about, some of the ideas that people started thinking about were what we might call the misconceptions now, but at the time they were very possible. So, you know, volcanoes, maybe they could cause ozone to deplete, maybe salt in the seawater, because there's a lot of chlorine in there. If eventually you get a lot of sea mist, and that might wander up to the atmosphere. This is maybe a natural phenomenon. We didn't notice it before. All sorts of questions like that. Let's see.
Were they taking earlier ozone studies before this, or to compare the data with, or was it would the cycles normally come out of their first test?
Well, the cycle, this phenomenon that it sort of happens throughout the, especially in the winter of the south hemisphere, the southern part of the world, really came out of, it comes from the fact that during that time, the air above Antarctica gets extremely cold, and they develop something very unusual called a polar stratospheric cloud. That was known, that they developed these clouds in the cold time of the winter there. And normally clouds don't go above the troposphere, and it's rare to have clouds in the stratosphere. But it's fairly common in the Antarctic region to have polar stratospheric clouds. So that was one factor. But the other thing is, well, what then is going to cause this ozone depletion? And a lot of people thought, oh, chlorine must be doing it. But why is it getting concentrated down there? Aren't all the releases in the northern hemisphere, and doesn't it just stay down there? If we look at amount or concentration of chlorofluorocarbons as a function of North Pole to South Pole, once they're released from most of the industrialized countries, at least the bulk producers of chlorofluorocarbons, it gets quite homogenized throughout the whole Earth's atmosphere. There are very few boundaries or borders in the atmosphere. And you can see that there's only a slight difference in, this is an artist rendering, of course, of a nice pretty graph. But as you can see from this, you can also see why I didn't go into art. The line sort of goes down and goes down to the South Pole. Basically, you have very even distributions of these chlorofluorocarbons throughout the whole atmosphere. Okay. Then the next thing that happened, so we're getting chlorofluorocarbons, they go up in the upper atmosphere, they disassociate, cause ozone depletion, but why so much in the Antarctica? Well, what turns out happened is these clouds, they're solid, and they absorb molecules to the side of these crystals. And so chlorine, this free atomic chlorine, will go to the side of the crystal, and then when an ozone molecule hits the side too, there's a much higher probability that they can find each other and react. And so it's something called a solid phase or a solid phase catalyst. So that these clouds, in a sense, are catalyzing the ozone reaction beyond what the scientists who originally thought about this predicted. And so they're seeing decreases in ozone concentration 50% to 60% from normal.
And that's because of the cold. The cold makes the clouds cause the catalyst.
Yeah, well, the clouds provide a host, essentially.
Now, how dangerous is a hole in the Antarctic area when it doesn't receive the sun as the equator?
Well, it's dangerous in the... I mean, you can in one sense say there aren't many people living there, there aren't many biological organisms living there. There are quite a few species of animals that do live in the area. So there's concern that the ecological cycle there could be damaged. But the bigger concern is what happens in the future. Every year since 1979, this ozone hole had been growing. It started out to be a small portion of Antarctica. It kept getting larger and larger until just recently it actually was going up, hitting South America, getting up to Venezuela. And so the question is it going to keep growing? Is it only localized over Antarctica? Because there's a similar phenomenon in the North Pole. And recently, they're starting to notice that the ozone is being depleted in the North Pole also. But in addition to that, there's depletion throughout the whole Earth in many places. places. It's not just in the poles, but they were sort of a warning sign. But let's see.
You didn't answer his question. He said, what will it do to us? What is the damage the ozone is?
Well, if it were only there, it wouldn't do any damage. But if it were other places, it would continue to damage. In the same sense that I talked about in the beginning, the less ozone we have, the more UV light that gets sent through the atmosphere to us. And so not only will people have increased occurrences of malignant skin cancer, decreased immune response, increased incident of cataracts, decreased levels of, it goes on and on like this. So anything, UV light is very high energy. It can essentially break bonds, many bonds besides an ozone bond, the bonds in ozone. It can also break bonds, chemical bonds in your skin, your DNA, things like that. Does that get closer to your question? So the question was still, what is really causing the ozone depletion? And there were many ideas that went into that. And finally, in 1984, NASA had sent a satellite up called UARS, the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite. And that was able to really measure concentrations of all sorts of chemicals in the upper atmosphere. And what they discovered in using that satellite is that there was atomic fluorine in the upper atmosphere in the ozone hole. And there is no known natural occurrence of fluorine that could get into the atmosphere, whereas there could be a natural occurrence of chlorine coming from volcanoes or the sea. And finding the concentration of fluorine in the upper atmosphere above the ozone hole, that really allowed them to calculate the concentrations of all the other species that participate. And what they found is essentially they could account for almost all chlorine, fluorine, and bromine in the ozone hole. And in a sense, deduced that it had to be coming from human-produced, non-naturally occurring chlorine compounds. But there were mainly four misconceptions that go into the ozone pool question or ozone depletion. One of the ones was, if CFCs are contain five atoms, they probably weigh a lot more than oxygen or nitrogen, so why don't they just settle out like most heavy things do if you think about weight and settling? As it turns out, if you were to take ozone and put it in a box and didn't allow any air current to flow, then it would, over a long period of time, eventually settle to the bottom. But because of the atmospheric conditions we have, it really gets mixed very well and will eventually wander up through the tropopause into the stratosphere. And this is a... put up a little higher. This is another plot where you're looking at concentration of ozone in one direction and height in kilometers in the other axis. And we can see that concentration of, this is CFC-11, which is actually the little molecule I have here. This concentration of this is a function of how far you go up in the atmosphere. And it's pretty constant up until you get to about in here is the region that the stratosphere starts, the troposphere ends, about 10, 12 kilometers. And the ozone layer exists from about 15 to 30 kilometers. And you can see that there's quite a large concentration of CFC-11 all the way up into, there's a measurable amount of CFCs there. If you notice the unit, this is parts per, not million, not parts per billion, but parts per trillion. So we're talking the size of our national debt. $1 in our national debt, roughly speaking. But because of the phenomenon we talked about, that catalytic activity, the chlorine can then, one chlorine can damage so many ozone molecules, it doesn't take a large concentration in that area. So where are the things? Essentially, the other things I was sort of showing that CFCs have a fairly even concentration throughout all the atmosphere. Since we produced most of it in North America, we were actually being generous and donating to the rest of the world. We didn't have to. There's such good mixing that it really is quite everywhere. So that was one of the common misconceptions. Another one that was really quite another misconception, or at least possibility that turned out not to be very possible, was that volcanoes could then be, when they explode, send tremendous amounts of material up into the atmosphere and eventually go into the stratosphere and deposit chlorine there, and that might be causing the ozone depletion. And from data from two recent volcanoes, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, but El Chichon, I don't know how you pronounce that, in 1982, and Mount Pinatubo in 1991 were very large volcanoes. And in following the results of those volcanoes, they send tremendous amounts of material ash up in the sky. It can go up into the upper reaches of the troposphere, almost reaching the stratosphere. And what it does is it sends up a little aerosol, they call it, or small particles. And they act a lot like those clouds do in the South Pole, or the air above the South Pole, in that they provide a place for chemistry to take place on. So the ozone could be depleted in that sense, too. But what turned out is that if you look at the volcanic activity over the recent time period, and also look at ozone depletion, there really is no great increase in volcanic activity over that time. Anything else you want to say before I take this one? Also, the chlorine that volcanoes usually put into the air is usually hydrochloric acid, HCl, and that's very soluble in water. So whenever it rains, it essentially cleanses the troposphere, and so that removes most of that. And scientists like a lot of graphs, I guess. It's a very compact way. A picture is worth a thousand words. And this is a graph of the aerosol released from Mount Pinatubo. It exploded about halfway through 1991, and I was actually up at Holden fairly soon after this, about this time, and there was a geologist here from Vancouver, Washington, who had gone to track some of the I think he's interested in avalanches and mudslides after volcanoes. But what various people were doing, they were studying the amount of aerosol that was sent into the air from this volcano, and then looked at how long it took for the atmosphere to cleanse itself of this aerosol. And it really only took about maybe a year, 2 years to remove the bulk of the aerosol from the volcano. So there is some potential to increase ozone depletion from a volcano, but it's fairly insignificant compared to the chlorofluorocarbons. Another one of the things people were saying, well, okay, so the ozone hole is over Antarctica. What do we care? We just put on another hat, find another bottle of sunscreen. It's, you know, if we go down there, but it shouldn't affect us in other parts of the world. And what I was trying to get at, I guess, when someone over here asked a question, is that really it is getting depleted over many parts of the world. And there are measurements from balloons, satellites, and ground-based stations. And long-term trends also show that ozone concentration is going down. One picture that I talked about, we looked at yesterday, a couple of them actually, was a picture from, there are only a few places in the world that started really monitoring ozone early, and they were just doing that from a pure scientific point of view, wanted to learn about it. And they didn't see any ozone change, didn't notice much, but started to see in the late 70s, even to about this point, it's hard to convince yourself that that might not be normal variations in concentration, because ozone concentrations do change quite a lot naturally. You know, a volcano or sunspots might increase ozone for a little while because there's increased amounts of UV light. but at least it demonstrates that ozone is decreasing as measured in the places that aren't in the pools. And then something I also showed yesterday, so you may see this again, but just to sort of show where Seattle would fit in here, or Holden, in 1979 and 1994. This is a picture from the same satellite that we showed the ozone hole from. It's something called the Nimbus 7. And there's an instrument on that satellite called the TOMS, which is the Total Ozone Monitoring Spectrometer, I think. And it essentially maps ozone concentration over the whole globe. What we see is, in 1979, we're about in the orange-ish area here, somewhere maybe 375 Dobson units. And then as time goes on, we're moving down into the yellow or somewhere in this area. I can't quite tell the difference between the yellows. It must be 350 or so. So there's been a decrease in ozone concentration above the United States. It's not tremendously lower, because you can see that if you go down to maybe California, go down to Mexico, Latin America, the ozone layer does get naturally gets a little thinner. And we're not down to those levels, but you do then have to think about your normal exposure to sun and UV light. There also were people who suggested that there really isn't a link between ozone concentration and UV levels on the surface of the Earth. And this is a plot of some data from the South Pole showing that if you have X percent of reduction in the ozone layer, how much increase in UV light you see. And so it's about, some sources say it's about a 1-to-1 ratio for every percent you go up in, or every percent you go down in ozone, you go up in UV light. But this is a little bit steeper than that. Maybe 2% up in UV light versus 1% down in ozone. So it is, you know, that really is the only barrier between that kind of UV light and us. A few pages later. Oh, any of the younger members of the audience, there's a quote from a pop singer in the 80s, or actually I think it was one of the lyrics, from Huey Lewis, if you remember that. There's a quote that's pretty, I think, apropos to the ozone question. My future's so bright, I've got to wear shades. So I was going through all this and it brought back that memory here. Well, now for some good news, perhaps. I was talking to a few people beforehand, and people mentioned that they'd heard that the ozone hole is getting smaller now. What else have you folks heard? I think, Chris, you mentioned something yesterday. I think
it was a front page article about some measurements that were saying that they might be turning a corner on how much CFC release is happening into the atmosphere, and that would lead to over time to a reverse in the trend. Mm-hmm. That they're, for the first measurable results are coming back that give hints at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what that article was referring to is a paper published in a journal called Science. And it's the title of the article is "The Decline in Tropospheric Abundance of Halogen," which basically chlorine, fluorine, and bromine are halogen atoms, "from CFCs and implications for the stratospheric ozone depletion." And before I talk about that, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the reason for the decrease, and that's really the Montreal Protocol. Let me give you the full name. Montreal Protocol on Substances that Deplete the Ozone Layer. So that's the title of this conference that was held in 1977 in Montreal. And when they finished that conference, the countries that came to this agreed that by the year 1999, they would decrease production by 50% of all CFC chemicals. Okay. Then the information about the ozone layer became more, is an ozone hole became more prominent. And so they got back together 2 years later in London and amended that in June of 1990. And they said, okay, well, we'll have complete cessation of CFC emissions by the year 2000. Okay, and then they kept learning more and the hole kept getting bigger, and they got together in Copenhagen 2 years later and amended the protocol again and added an accelerated phase out of not only chlorofluorocarbons, but halons, which are compounds which include bromine. Because have you ever heard of halon fire extinguishers? There's a number of other uses for halons. They're basically things that have, instead of chlorofluoro, they have maybe chlorobromo or fluorobromo. They have a bromine. And let's see. Oh, okay, now here's where we get to really look at the production curves now. So, I guess it's a little downhill here. In more ways than one. So after about 1988 to 1990, global production of ozone started decreasing. And right now, we're about 1996, and we should be somewhere in this region, I'm guessing. But so, you know, there was a marked difference in production levels. I mean, that didn't take anything out of use that was already being used, but it stopped production. Okay. And some of the implications that this treaty has is that we expect now that the chlorine level in the upper atmosphere and stratosphere should peak around the year 2000 or something close to 2000. At least that's what they thought when they did the Montreal Protocol after Copenhagen, all three versions of the modification. One challenge they haven't yet dealt with much is something, another molecule called bromomethane. If you're familiar with agriculture, grain storage, one of the ways they... It's my daughter.
I was leaving for choir
now. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. She doesn't want to stretch it out. Well, bromomethane is a fumigant. It's often used because it's simple. It's a gas. They sort of take a gas cylinder, open it up in a big grain bin, and kill all the little things that like to eat grain, so they can preserve the grain longer. There's a lot of other environmental concerns about using that as a fumigant, and the fact that it can diffuse into the grain and not be the greatest thing to ingest. But it's been hard to add that control to the Montreal Protocol, and so that's not set to be phased out until 2003 or 2004, something like that. But one interesting thing about halons and bromine, or the bromo compounds, or bromine compounds, is that bromine can be up to 50 or 40 to 50 to even 100 times more efficient at killing ozone than chlorine can. But a good thing about it is it only lasts in the atmosphere about a year, much less than some of the other compounds. Other things, let me see. Highlights here, how we're doing. That's super. The peak losses in the areas that perhaps we're most concerned about are places that the bulk of the population live. And if we compare the 1960s to now, and when we see the peak in the late 90s here, we'll probably see about a 12 to 13% decrease in ozone layers, ozone levels above the northern hemisphere in the winter and spring months, and about a 6% decrease in the summer and fall. In the southern hemisphere, you'll probably see about a 12 or 10, 11% decrease throughout the whole cycle. And that has to do with some source effects and also the mixing and atmospheric effects. But we can, let's go to one other graph here. When I show what this is a graph of chlorine concentration or chlorine content in the stratosphere. And if we go up to about here, this is sort of real data. Anything on this side is prediction. And A is Copenhagen, A is the first Montreal conference. So if we were to take those values of production for CFCs and related compounds, they would have, the chlorine content would have been going up at about that level. And which maybe wouldn't have been so good about the year 2100, or any time in between. And after the meeting in London in 1990, and revised the phase outs, we would have seen an increase in the chlorine concentration about like the thing label B. And finally, after Copenhagen, they finally got it down to the point where we're actually going to see a decrease after roughly the year 2000, 2001, they're initially thinking. And maybe by the time we get to 2050, we might be at levels we were in the 1980s in terms of chlorine content and hence ozone content. And as it turns out, let's see. Well, let's just skip right to the article. And as it turns out, a number of scientists have been measuring various types of chlorofluorocarbons in the upper atmosphere, especially in the troposphere, the ones that are progressing towards the stratosphere. And for the first time, they've seen the first decrease in concentration of some of the precursor molecules that would produce chlorine for the stratosphere. And in about 1994 was the turning point for about two or three of those compounds, and actually for the total chlorine content of the troposphere. So in about 1995, they started noticing now that the concentration of chlorine, or the effective concentration in the stratosphere in 5 or 6 years will be going down at about a rate of 25 parts per trillion per year. So that's a significant change from going up by about 110 parts per trillion per year for most of the time in the 80s and 90s. What else? And because we saw this peak in the total chlorine about 1994, 1995, what that means is it takes 3 to 5 years to get that all mixed up in the stratosphere. So somewhere between 1997 and 1999, we'll see the worst ozone we potentially could have. That's if we really judiciously and faithfully follow the Montreal protocols with all the amendments. And
is that doubtful?
Well, there's been some concern that there's going to be quite a black market in freon, because you know it's fairly good at air conditioning. Some countries aren't adhering to the protocols. Quite often, some developing countries say, "Well, you know, gosh, you folks have been using all of the natural resources, got to use this stuff for a long time. We can't afford to use all these substitutes, so we're going to use this cheap stuff, and it's easy to produce. We've got lots of methods that we know how to build plants to make it." So I think there is some concern that there won't be 100% compliance, but if in the countries that are producing it have compliance that they've agreed to, we still should have decreasing concentrations of chlorine and increasing concentrations of ozone for the first time starting after about 1998.
The ozone will replenish itself once the chlorine is taken out of the stratosphere.
Right. All these compounds have what's called a residence life, or a lifetime in the stratosphere. The bromo compounds, the halogens, have fairly short lifetimes, 1 to 5 years. Freon 12 has about a residence time of 100 years. Freon 11 is about a 50-year lifetime. And so it'll take that long for those compounds to get cleansed, so to speak, from naturally occurring processes of the stratosphere. But by the time we get to the year 2050 to 2100, we should start to see real significant decreases back to the sort of more normal levels for ozone for the Earth.
Comment. You mentioned the other meeting about the costing effect of the new type of material making. What was that? Was that really costing the new things when you said with the freon?
Well, they're very related compounds to the freons. They're probably things called a hydrochlorofluorocarbon. Basically, it's got a hydrogen instead of a fluorine, or a chlorine in some places. And what that does is it makes it a little bit more reactive, a little bit more prone to being depleted before it reaches the stratosphere. That also means it's more reactive in whatever it's in, too, probably. And so it may be a little bit more dangerous or cause more deterioration in the material it's being used for.
Yeah, so I've heard the automobile air conditioning system might last about 3 years and you need a new one.
Yeah.
I'm sure that. And how about then going back to ammonia, that would be a good thing to read it, would it?
For some industrial settings, it might be appropriate where you can control who will be where and you'll have a lot more control over how it's put together, who has access to the pipes, can maybe damage those and have leaks and response plans to deal with them.
No home mechanics, huh?
I think for a home product, I think it'd be very dangerous to have. But I think as time goes on, perhaps engineers will get better at designing an air conditioner or a refrigerator to deal with these other gases, either using other indestructible things like Teflon or something like that.
We don't really know either about some of the biological effects in the environment. Some people have said the worldwide reduction in frogs may be a result of the increase in ultraviolet rays, and some plants seem to be more prone to ultraviolet radiation than others.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that we don't know what that cumulative effect is going to be.
No, there's a lot of things like that. Frogs, at least in their early development stage, that's I guess when they're the most prone to damage by the UV light and getting the reproductive cycle going. There are a few others that I remember. I haven't seen much information on that recently, but I'm sure we'll see more papers and more discussion about what is being affected as we get closer to 1998, 1997, 99, and we really start to see the larger increases in UV light.
I'm just saying, we're not going to get close to the year 2000, so the fundamental cigarette tells us the world's going to end. We all know that it isn't going to end, and as Martin Luther said, if you think it's going to end tomorrow, plan for today. So.
Yes. I'm sure there'll be plenty of things. But I think that the next real question that we have to grapple with is global warming, and that's a much more challenging problem because ozone is simple. We can find a culprit in a sense, and we can control it, we can find ways around it. But global warming is a little bit more challenging because anything that produces carbon dioxide produces methane. There's a whole host of things that contribute to our ability to insulate the Earth. And we seem to be moving towards a hotter Earth at a pace that perhaps isn't very good. That's another week-long topic.
So how much effect would this have if the ozone does get replenished by the year 2050 or 2100? If we're back to having a good ozone situation, will that significantly impact global warming or not really because there's too many other factors going on?
Well, it should make a pretty sizable impact because the ozone depleting compounds are so much better at warming the Earth than ozone depleting compounds. Although some of the substitutes for ozone that we're starting to use now are even worse global warming chemicals than the ones we were using. So it's sort of a trade-off in what we've found so far, at least, that by using the new compounds in refrigeration, those have something in that ODP, that ozone depletion potential. The Montreal Protocol said anything below 0.2, anything above 0.2, we're going to wipe out. Won't produce on a commercial scale. Anything less than 0.2 will still allow with certain modifications. And most of the new refrigerants end up being about 0.1 or less in that scale. But they end up being, what's the number? C somewhere in the order of 5 to 20,000 in terms of the global warming potential. So they're very dangerous in terms of global warming.
But in what proportion to carbon dioxide? I mean, it's only 1%, even though it might be 1,000 times greater, it's right, only cumulative.
If it's a small percent, then that's...
It doesn't matter. Yeah. It's the carbon dioxide that's the problem.
Well, it's a lot of things besides carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, methane, a lot of things I can't remember. There's about 6 or 7 substantial percentages of that. I should look, it's about 720 or 722 or so, so I should say thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to stick around for a while, but let people get off to